Good evening and welcome to Radio Edutalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay, and I'm delighted to have on the show this evening Matt Barr of the University of Glasgow, and we're going to be talking over the next 20-25 minutes about a game study course that Matt runs, and an interesting new journal into gaming and all kind of related issues, and also we'll be hearing about some aspects of Matt's own PhD research. So welcome to Radio Edutalk.
Thanks, David.
And just to start off with, could you give us a kind of brief background to your career right up to date?
Yeah, sure. I've arrived where I am today by a somewhat convoluted route, as is not uncommon, I suspect. But I started out with a geology degree, of all things. I think probably the one thing I learned from that was what a poor student looked like, and that was me. But I've since put that behind me, and I started working in higher education in the IT department and in what was then called the Scottish Academy of Music and Drama, and work my way through working on websites and record systems, and eventually went back to university to do an MSc in IT. And then after a little jaunt in the private sector, working for a whiskey company, I came back to higher education to work as a developer, but with designs on moving into research and teaching. So here I am.
Okay, that's great. And you work within, is it referred to as Hattie, or is it pronounced differently? Yeah, can you tell us a bit about a particular department or area of the work of the university?
Yeah, sure. It's often a tricky question. It's not like you can just say you work in the psychology department or something. But HATI stands for the Humanities Advanced Technology and Information Institute, which is why we call it HATI. It's a bit easier. And it's based within the College of Arts in the University of Glasgow, and it's been there since 1997. So our research and teaching is quite varied. It includes areas like information studies, digital culture, digital humanities, and we have lots of expertise in digital curation and preservation. Perhaps the easiest way of describing what we do is the name of our undergraduate degree program, which is Digital Media and Information Studies, and that about sums it up. We have honours options that include my own game studies course, but also everything from humanity and transhumanity to enterprise, creativity, and citizenship online, heritage and cultural informatics, and so on and so on. And it's looking quite healthy, I have to say. We've got about 140 students enrolled at level one. Seems that we're increasingly in demand. But also at the postgraduate level, we have two very popular programs, one in museum studies and one in information management, plus, I'd say, about a dozen PhD students. And depending on which hat I'm wearing, I'm one of those.
Yeah, and so you're a university teacher, but also a PhD student. So, and we'll right. hopefully hear about that as the show goes on. But what are your own kind of personal and academic motivations in relation to wanting to do a PhD, and is it your own particular passion into in gaming?
Yeah, I mean, I was having to think about this, and I think I've always had an interest in technology, and particularly in games. I mean, I'm of the generation that has really grown up with games. You know, I'm late 30s. They've always been there, you know. And I can remember showing SimCity to my geography teacher in the early 90s and talking very enthusiastically about the educational potential of it. Now, unfortunately, I put that in the back burner for about 20 years. But that was that. Looking back, that was the seed of something, I think. But I've also had a long-standing, if maybe unspoken or unconscious, interest in teaching and learning. My mum's a teacher, so maybe that's an influence. But I remember when I went back to work at the Scottish Academy of Music and Drama. I was in the IT department, but I had a very understanding boss, and he let me put together a course for our postgraduate music students. And this was, you know, nearly 15 years ago, so. The idea was that these music students, when they graduated, would be probably finding a lot of their work through the internet. And at that time, for people from a non-technical background, so people from, say, from a music background, it wasn't particularly straightforward to get yourself a web presence. So the idea behind this course was to try and give our students something of an edge, I guess, when they graduated. And that's when I kind of sort of began to sort of rediscover this interest in teaching and learning. I think probably that sort of dual interest in technology plus what I now recognise as an interest in learning and teaching is probably the main driving force behind the PhD.
And I'll just say to listeners at this point, whether you're listening to the live stream or the podcast, you can get in touch with the show in two ways. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or pop something up on Twitter and include the hashtag edutalk, and be sure to pass your comments or questions on to Matt. Now, I think one of the projects that really jumps out for me, Matt, is your Games for Communication project, which I think is related somewhat to your PhD. Folk can obviously check the blog, and I'm sure we'll hear some kind of key links later on. But can you tell us what the Games for Communication project was about, and then maybe some of the kind of outcomes from that particular project?
Sure, yeah. So broadly, to set the scene, I suppose my research falls under the banner of game-based learning. So using video games in some shape or form for learning and teaching. My specific area is looking at how commercial video games, that is to say games that were developed, you know, for entertainment purposes rather than educational purposes, how those games might be used to help develop soft skills. So the sort of skills that my university and plenty of others call graduate attributes. So things like communication ability, critical thinking, resourcefulness, those sorts of softer skills that, if we're being honest, not all university courses were specifically designed to encourage or to develop. Of course, the idea is they're a byproduct of what you do at university, but courses aren't necessarily written to develop these things. And it struck me that perhaps video games are kind of geared up to rehearse or practice or exercise these various skills in a way that it's hard to replicate, say, in an exam. For example, when you sit down and do an exam paper, there's only so much communication, adaptability, resourcefulness that you can show in that scenario, whereas modern video games are quite often testing those very same competencies. So I looked at various graduate attributes. Our university has 10, nine of which were of interest to me, the 10th being subject specialists. So I'm not looking at games teaching you facts and figures or teaching an understanding of a particular subject, but rather the softer skills. And chief among those, I think, was communication. I did a little bit of preliminary work with some employers from various sectors just to get a feel for what they were interested in. And communication was one of those things that kept coming up in some shape or form. They were looking for people who could communicate. Of course, they were looking for all these other things as well, but communication seemed to be a running theme. So for this project, I got a little bit of funding from the RCUK Digital Economy Fund, and I was able to set up a sort of 8-week experiment. It was very small scale, just if it's just half a dozen, or really a dozen students involved, about a dozen saw it through to the end. And it was an opportunity for me to try out measures for these different skills. Of course, the beauty of an exam is that you can test people's knowledge, but we're less good or less familiar with testing these softer skills. So the first thing I had to do was to go through the literature and find some measures that could be used. So I came across the self-perceived communication competence scale from McCroskey and McCroskey and the communicative adaptability scale from Duran. Those are both self-reported multiple choice measures that allow people to estimate their communication competency, their abilities. As part of the project, I was a little bit sneaky, and I threw in a few other measures just because I could, with the idea that later on I would do a larger project that looked at a broader picture, not just communication. So I ran in the Rosenberg self-esteem scale, the general self-efficacy scale, the Big Five inventory for assessing personality, and a few other measures as well, including measures for adaptability, resourcefulness, and critical thinking. So I got my money's worth. I got my students to sit a whole battery of tests at the beginning of the 8 weeks. Then each week we met for 2 hours at a prescribed time and played the games that I had chosen for them. I didn't choose them by myself. I got some input from colleagues in industry and in game studies academia. and we chose games that, you know, had some, by and large, had some kind of communication element to them. So at the beginning of, I had a score for the beginning of the session, of the 8 weeks, sorry, and a score for the end, and I ran those through, totaled them up, had a little look at to see what the overall differences were, and for the communication scales, I actually found that the mean scores actually changed in the positive sense. So in other words, on average, people, their scores went up for both communication measures. Now, of course, that in and of itself isn't conclusive. So I also had a look at, I calculated the 95% confidence intervals just to see, is this a chance occurrence? And in both cases, the change in mean didn't cross zero. So it looked like there was a very good chance that these were not just random occurrences. Now, the numbers were small. There was no control group. And so what I'm currently doing is doing a much larger scale study. And I've had some initial figures back from that, which are pretty encouraging, I have to say. So the measures I was using are Robert E. Ployhart. He came up with a measure of adaptability called I-ADEPT-M. So it's about individual adaptability. I found a resourcefulness scale from Jacqueline Zanuski, I think it is. And also I looked at some other tests like the Innes Weir critical thinking essay test. Now, the pilot was useful because I got to try these measures out to see what might work on a larger scale. And perhaps predictably enough, I found that the simple multiple choice, quick and easy measures were kind of the most reliable. Anyone who's looked at critical thinking will be familiar with the Innes Weir test, which involves, it's a bit like, it reminded me of, you know, those comprehension exercises you might do at school. You know, read a passage and then sort of write something that shows your understanding of that passage. The problem with that sort of approach is, and there's a sort of fake letter to a newspaper that you have to assess critically. The problem with that is if you do it multiple times, your respondents, your participants are going to get, you know, pretty cheesed off because it is a little bit more effort required.
Yeah.
And also, I wasn't entirely confident that if you'd seen it multiple times over the course of an intervention that you wouldn't maybe learn the tricks. You know, it might become less valid. And what I did notice in the pilot scheme was that while communication and some other measures improved, critical thinking didn't, and in some cases actually went down. And that's basically because, well, students are human beings, and when you're faced with something you didn't enjoy once, when you get it again, you're not going to give it your full attention. So that was useful. So I decided that while I wanted to test critical thinking, it wasn't really practical. So I settled on communication, resourcefulness, and adaptability because I had good measures. And if I can give you a little preview of the results on the bigger study.
Yeah, that'd be fascinating, yeah.
I'm hoping to publish this pretty soon because I'm quite pleased with the results, I have to say. The scale is a bit bigger, so I aim to recruit 100 students, 100 undergraduate students from the College of Arts, and I split those into two groups of 50. So I did a randomized controlled style. I put 50 in one group, 50 in the other. One group, the control group, they did not play the games at all. They just took the tests in week one and the tests again in week eight. The rest of them came into a lab that I had set up especially in the Hattie basement, where they could drop in and play certain games. Now, those games were informed by the pilot, of course, and there was a slightly greater focus on communication just because that seemed like the most promising attribute. Some of the lessons learned from the pilot I put into effect. So, for example, I made it a drop-in, so I had the lab open maybe 3 days a week, and people could drop in when it suited them rather than having a fixed period each week. And that helped with retention. You know, students were able to come along and play whenever it suited them, but also it addressed one of the common criticisms of games research, and that is the sort of ecological validity, if you like. It's not telling people to come to a lab at a certain time to play for, you know, exactly 90 minutes or exactly 2 hours. Is not typically how they play games at home, right? It's, or it's how they play games in their spare time. It tends to be whenever it suits them, and it tends to be for as long as they like, so, or as short as they like. So that added to the sort of validity of the test, I felt. Anyway, I recorded their test scores actually every single week after each different game they played. I recorded it. I've yet to process all of that information, but the headline is that for the communication adaptability scale, I got a pretty significant result in that the intervention group, the group that played the video games over the 8 weeks, had a statistically significant higher score on the communication adaptability scale. With a p-value which I'm still checking and double-checking because I can't quite believe it myself, but the p-value there was 0.0041. So that suggests that that was not a chanced occurrence. That, and also you have to remember it was randomized, so that helps control away the effects of, as you'd expect, you know, a semester at university, one would hope there would be some personal growth. But the fact that it was randomized hopefully addressed that concern. And the two other measures I looked at were resourcefulness, which had a p-value of 0.0134, and adaptability, which was 0.0019. So it's really looking, I mean, it's early days, I need to write this up and publish it, but it's looking like I've got some pretty strong evidence for these games actually improving these soft skills. The final statistic I'll throw out there, which I'm sure if you haven't had enough already, is the effect size. I calculated Cohen D, and it was over 0.9 for the communication scores, which is typically classified as big, taking into account the variability amongst the students. So in terms of how the pilot has fed into the larger study is looking good. It's not finished yet. I need to write it up, but it's looking promising.
I can't wait to read the final report, Matt. And can you say at this point then what kind of implications there might be from this larger scale research into our approaches to so-called games-based learning in a kind of formal learning environment?
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, games in formal learning environments, it's not without, you know, it's not without challenges, and I faced a number of those. Having been a good student and done my literature review, I was prepared for them, of course, most of them, but things like, well, it's the nuts and bolts stuff. Anyone who's taught with technology in a lab of some kind will know that the stuff can go wrong, right? So there's always that challenge. And there's also, with the games, when you're using games for teaching or for teaching and learning, the person who's doing the teaching, the facilitator, the tutor, the lecturer, whatever it is, they need to be familiar with these games as well. That was something that I had picked up on in the literature and recognized as an issue, and perhaps will come onto my course later on, but it's the same as when you're teaching about games. As soon as a question comes up and you can't answer, everything gets derailed. So there are some unique challenges, yes, for using video games in a formal learning environment, but I think some of the approaches that I took here, like making a drop-in session, for example, rather than a fixed time, certainly helped with that. So yes, that was certainly an issue. I was drawing on work. There was a particular piece of work by Kurt Squire, who's based at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and is director of the Games Learning Society Initiative in the States. He did some really inspiring work with another commercial game, with Civilization III, and he used that to teach social history. And I recommend checking out his book. It's Video Games and Learning, Teaching and Participatory Culture in the Digital Age, I think, something like that. Kurt Squire, anyway. And he took this game into the classroom, and from what I understand, it was a bunch of students who weren't necessarily excelling. They'd been through the course a few times, and they weren't engaged. And the game just sort of clicked with them, with most of them, I should say. That's one of the issues. I'll come back to that. But and these guys, they started really learning stuff, and not facts and figures, not historical facts and figures, and this is the cue that I took from Kurt's work. It was the systemic thinking, the kind of critical thinking, the, you know, communicating with one another, the kind of softer skills, again, around the game. It was about recognizing the game was a system, and they started coming up with quite advanced notions of bias. You know, what's the bias in this? Why were in America, of course, so they started thinking, well, why is America currently the force it is in the world? So they were able to sort of do some sort of thought experiments around that stuff. So, but Squire, he identified some issues with this, and he came up with a solution in terms of using these games in a formal environment, and that was what he called just-in-time lectures. So whenever the class, roughly as a whole, hit a certain point, he would take a little break and just do a little two-minute mini-lecture to explain a concept, and then they'd move on. Now, I think the implications for my work are slightly different in that I'm looking at, you know, adults here. A lot of the work in game-based learning has been done with kids, but I'm looking at adults. As I said, I'm late 30s. I'm basically bang on the average age of the people who play games, and I'm looking at university students here. This has implications in terms of, well, A, as I said at the start, I don't feel that all university courses are designed to develop these soft skills, but if games can, then that's an opportunity for universities to perhaps explore the possibility of introducing games in some shape or form to the curriculum, or at least to the opportunities available on campus, in much the same way as sports or debating or something like that is often encouraged at university. The other thing is, games get a bad press, right? There's often some fairly alarmist coverage in the press about the ill effects of video games. If I'm able to show that games, and there wasn't really much facilitation from me. I just put them in a room with a particular game to play. If games are able to develop these useful skills, then we need to look quite carefully at this sort of this argument that games are bad for you, because I think this and other studies like it hopefully can show that games are potentially good for us too.
Matt, I'm sure we could talk all night. I'm certainly wanting to go into a couple of other areas of your work in a moment. Just going back to the pilot, and I think this is maybe continued in aspects of your current work. It looked to me from reading the Games for Communication blog that you were kind of dropping in kind of text-based and maybe live events where it was people involved in developing games that you were maybe playing, that they were kind of having some kind of input, or was that kind of interview transcript that you were putting up as well?
That's right, yeah. So part of what I was looking at was, it wasn't just, at least initially, it wasn't just that communication between players. It was also a notion I wanted to explore of whether the games, or the game developers, the designers, were communicating with the players.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting thing to explore, especially if I could detect whether the developers had intended to communicate something. So I interviewed a couple of the developers involved in the games, one of which was Carla Zamonia, who worked on Gone Home, and Grant Roberts, who worked on Never Alone, which are two of the games I used in the pilot. And both felt that they were indeed trying to communicate something to the player. Of course, any well-designed game has to communicate the nuts and bolts of the mechanics of the story and, you know, how it all works. So any successful game is going to do that. But these guys, and they're not, I suspect they're not unique in this, they also wanted to communicate some larger themes. So for Grant on Never Alone, it was an interesting sort of cooperative platform puzzly sort of game, but it was made in collaboration with an Alaskan Native tribe. And all of the lore and all of the story and all of the setting was drawn from their culture. And he wanted to sort of impart something of that culture to the players. So that's what he was seeking to communicate. Whereas Carla's goals with Gone Home were maybe a little bit more subtle. She talked about ideas like women are interesting people and teenagers have real feelings. Because in Gone Home, the protagonist, the character you play, I suppose, is a young woman. I won't spoil the game, but she explores her childhood home and various aspects of her and her family's life are revealed. So in both cases, they were trying to communicate something to the player as well, which I thought was interesting.
Now, the main part of your work now as a university teacher will be delivering on or running the Introduction to Video Game Studies course. So it's a relatively new course, as I understand. So you tell us a bit about how it's structured and the content and how you feel it's developing.
Yeah, sure. So it's only been going a couple of years now. This is the third year it's run, so it certainly still feels new, but it's got into that, it's kind of found its groove, at least I hope it has. So it's an honours option for our digital media undergraduates. And indeed, anyone from across the College of Arts and beyond can take it. So the course tends to attract a fairly high degree or high proportion of film and TV students, but also we've got people coming in from computing science, which I have to say from a teaching point of view is really interesting because, you know, by and large, if you're in a particular faculty or a particular college, you don't get quite as much interplay of disciplines there, but it's really interesting to see our digital media guys in the same room as a bunch of film students and some computing science students. You know, it's very different perspectives. But that's kind of part and parcel with game studies. It's essentially multidisciplinary. But our focus is very much, we're definitely based in the College of Arts. According to my colleagues at the Glasgow Caledonian University, where they teach the more vocational game design and development courses, according to their research, we're the only course in Scotland that's doing game studies in and of itself in Scotland at this level. So that's kind of cool. And I have to say, you know, respect to my boss for allowing me to put this forward. Game studies is not something that's traditionally taught at old school ancient universities like Glasgow. So it's nice to be sort of leading the way there. And I do believe that, you know, it's going to be like film studies was 50 years ago. It's initially people are a little bit uncertain of where it sits and why it's there. But it's in my mind, as games become more and more mainstream and just part of the everyday culture, it's going to be a no-brainer, like film studies. You know, well, of course we would study these culturally significant artifacts. You know, so as I said, it's not vocational in nature. I leave that to my colleagues at Caledonian and Abertay, but it's more akin, I suppose, to a film studies course where we're treating these objects seriously. We're examining them in terms of them being cultural artifacts, perhaps even works of art. I would certainly say that they're works of art, but we go through the history of the industry, of the medium, which, given how young it is, it's a very vibrant and interesting history. And it's something that I think it fits really well with our digital media course because so much of what is happening with games relates to the wider digital media scene, you know, in terms of how games are funded. I think that Kickstarter, you've got the social media interaction. There's all kinds of stuff that relates very closely to our other courses. We do touch on games design and development in a very high-level sense. I always make sure we get a couple of guest speakers in with industry experience. Just apart from anything else, it reassures the students I'm not making it up. but we do a little bit of basic game design, and I noticed this year we use two different tools for that. There's a tool called Game Maker, which allows you to very straightforwardly create a little graphical-based games, but also a tool called Twine, which is for creating text-based adventures, a bit like the old choose-your-own-adventure books. I noticed a lot of my students this year have created interactive stories that were seemed to feature a grumpy lecturer called Matt. But that aside, that was something of a success. And actually, I'm going to put some of my students forward to... there's a competition being run by the British Library in conjunction with the National Video Game Arcade that is encouraging students to create games based around the works of Shakespeare. So I've collared a few of my students and said, we're gonna represent the arts and humanities and put forward a few games. So, but yeah, we take a broad view of games. We look at the industry, the way it's structured, the emerging trends, you know, things like the way games are monetized these days, virtual reality, that kind of stuff. We look at the preservation of games as cultural artifacts, which again ties into a lot of the work we do at Hattie in terms of digital preservation and curation. And of course, inevitably, we touch on the positive and negative outcomes associated with games. You know, the sort of, we look at the debate around whether, you know, violent video games make people violent or whether playing video games makes you smarter, that kind of stuff. So it's a very varied course, but that's part of the beauty of teaching it, I think.
I'm conscious of the time, Mark. I'm really interested to hear about the Press Start Journal. It's you know, this is not an area that really features in my own kind of teaching practice presently, but I've kind of followed the first couple of editions of the journal. So can you just tell us about what, you know, where Press Start came from, and again how it's developing, and just a wee bit about, I know you've got a kind of call for papers at the moment around this next special issue, which I think is entitled Negotiating Gamer Identities, so feel free to put a wee call out to our listeners regarding that.
Thanks. Yes, so Press Start is a student-led game studies journal. It is peer-reviewed. It does have an ISSN. It's run like a real journal. It is a real journal. You can find it in Google Scholar. But it was born out of what I thought was a little gap in the market, as it were. What tends to happen is we don't have game studies departments, not yet, anyway, in most universities. And if they are games departments, they tend to be, you know, games development, games design courses. What tends to happen then is games are studied in other subjects, in little pockets that don't necessarily have a... So if someone writes a really good dissertation, a really good essay in psychology or film or English literature about games, not there's necessarily somewhere for it to go, if that makes sense. If you wrote a really good essay in something in psychology, say, for example, or in comparative literature, then your tutor, your lecturer would be able to point you towards the next step, the place you might want to publish that, for example. So the idea behind Press Start was to try and provide a platform for people, for students in various disciplines to sort of, you know, gather around and submit their work. It's not just about publishing work, although there's, you know, prestige involved in that, and just it's great for a student to get their work published in a peer-reviewed journal, but it's also the process. It's the entire editorial board are students from across the globe, from the States to Australia, and the reviewers are all, and the authors, everyone involved is a student. So there's a great community of people who can critique each other's work, but also gain experience of critiquing other people's work, which of course is, as those of us who have done it for a while will know, that that's a great way of critiquing your own work and improving your own writing. So it's about learning, but it's also about providing an opportunity to publish work that might otherwise sort of go unnoticed. Do you want me to speak about the little call for papers, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe just before you do, Matt, you know, you're kind of hinting that there's a number of issues, controversies around kind of gamer identities. So if you get time just to touch on a couple of them. For example, you mentioned in the kind of blurb or the call for papers for this special issue about Gamergate that I had no idea was currently ongoing as a controversy until I searched the hashtag on Twitter, and there's posts, several posts every minute about it, and seemingly yeah. It's a big issue in the world at present.
I think, the scale and the long tail on the Gamergate thing has been a surprise to most of us. It's, as you may have noticed if you're going through the tweets, it's a very emotive and divisive issue. And I'll be absolutely honest, I think my editorial board would agree with me in saying that, you know, we were in two minds about putting a call like this out, because anything associated with that Gamergate tag can attract potentially unwanted attention, I would say. And yes, we were still a little bit unsure about where this is going to go, but for now we're sticking with it. It's going to be very hard for me to describe what Gamergate is without, you know, raising the ire of somebody, but yeah, my thought is that the hashtag actually, weirdly enough, came from the actor Adam Baldwin, but it refers to an incident with a game developer called Zoe Quinn, and her ex posted some untrue claims about her, which I won't go into. You can certainly look those up. And this became a debate about ethics and games journalism, and about how games researchers and maybe developers were forcing some sort of evil feminist agenda on gamers or something along those lines. And this term, social justice warriors, was coined as a pejorative term, as a bad thing to be doing, fighting for social justice. And there were some fairly nasty side effects where people like Zoe Quinn, Lee Alexander, Felicia Day received, you know, death threats and so on as well over Twitter. As someone who's been playing games for over a quarter, nearly 30 years, about 30 years, I found it very disheartening. I felt we had made a lot of progress. The demographic had widened. There were lots more people playing games who'd never played games before. We have games that examine depression, games that allow you to play as a trans woman going through hormone therapy. There are games where you can be a mummy badger if you want, you know, and take your cubs in the wilderness. There are all kinds of interesting and new aspects of games. I felt that games were becoming more inclusive. And my perception, as I said, there are other perceptions that are available, is that Gamergate was kind of reset the clock a little bit on that stuff. It was kind of a step backwards, but it's not everybody's take. And what I'm hoping to achieve with, that's absolutely just my opinion, what I'm hoping to achieve with the call for papers is that I would love people who have a different opinion from me to come forward and submit to the journal as well. Everything that gets submitted to the journal goes through exactly the same process. So as long as something is, you know, it's gone through the academic rigor as required, as well, and I've written all the rest, it can get published. So if there's someone who's perhaps more pro Gamergate than me, then they should submit something, and, you know, we'd be delighted to see it in there. Because apart from anything else, I think it'd be great for people like me who don't quite get it to try and understand it a little bit better. I don't know if it's going to happen. I know that some people feel that we're damned if we do, damned if we don't. You know, if yeah. we get rejected, then we might look as being anti-Gamergate. But that's something will only get rejected if it fails the academic rigor that everything else goes through. You know, so it's an interesting time.
I would imagine there's many other controversies and issues in terms of negotiating gaming identities. It's not just going to revolve around that particular hashtag.
Absolutely not. I mean, that's the aspect of the call that's attracted the most attention, understandably enough. But no, there are all kinds of issues to be unpicked here. I mean, even the term gamer is has different connotations for different people. You know, and then there are sort of more interesting socioeconomic aspects. I think recently it was published that adult women gamers outnumber teenage boys. Now, you tell that to the average person on the street, and that'll come as something of a surprise. But it's not really, given, you know, the last 10 years of mobile phones and Nintendo's work with the Wii and the DS and so on. The demographic has widened significantly. And the thing is that people who do play games don't always identify as a gamer. You know, like, my wife wouldn't say I'm a gamer, but, you know, she's played her fair share of Plants vs. Zombies, Monument Valley, and even Mario Kart, you know. So I think just getting to the bottom of who we are as gamers and what does that mean is really quite interesting.
So just before you leave us, Matt, and thanks again for coming on EduTalk. It's been fascinating. You know, where are the kind of what kind of key links? Where should we be looking? What kind of key terms should we be firing into your search engines to find out more about your work, the work of Hattie, and I suppose the kind of big issues in this field worldwide at present?
Sure. Yeah. Well, for the game-based learning stuff, there's definitely a couple of names I would mention. I mean, Kurt Squire, as I've already mentioned, is a personal favourite of mine. But there's James Paul G, who's a professor of literary studies at Arizona State, I think. He's been a really influential advocate for game-based learning. He comes from a literary background, but he had a sort of epiphany some years back when he saw, I can't remember if it was his son or his nephew, playing a game, and he sort of picked up on this sort of new literacy that was there. So one of the key texts, one I think is really worth reading, is James Paul G's What Video Games Have to Teach Us About Learning, which I've just got the name of it the wrong. You'll find it if you Google it. James Paul G, Kurt Squire as well. And I think there's lots of other interesting writing on games. There's Jesper Juhl's Half Real, which is a great book that introduces a lot of the sort of concepts behind game studies. I use that quite extensively in the teaching. You should also, of course, check out Press Start as a journal. But there are other journals. There's gamestudies.org, there's Games and Culture. And I should mention that for the first time, the two big game studies conferences are co-locating, and it happens to be in Scotland. So in August, I think it's the 1st to the 6th of August, the DIGRA conference, that's the Digital Games Research Association, and FDG, which is the Foundations of Digital Games, they are co-locating in Dundee, organised by Abertay University, and that's going to bring, if you just look that up, you will find the whole smorgasbord of game studies. and it's quite exciting that it's happening here.
Matt, thanks again for taking time out to appear on Radio EduTalk. Best wishes for the future, and I hope we can meet again online and have you back on the show sometime in the weeks and months to come.
Sure, love to. Thanks, David.
Take care. All the best.